Friday, and that means another edition of the Zaghibi Report, Real and Unscripted. Every Friday, Jeremy and I go through some news of the day, and oftentimes from different perspectives, competing perspectives, but always respectfully discuss them with each other. How are you doing this week, Jer?
Well, do you want the American answer or the British answer?
Oh, I'm intrigued. Give me both.
Well, the American answer would be absolutely perfect, right? The British answer would be just terrible.
All right. Okay. We'll let folks marinate over that. So I'm literally just pulling these out of my hat right now in terms of topics. It is September 10th. And of course, September 11th was 20 years ago. And you and I are father and son. I want to talk about September 11th and its impact, or for that matter, even lack thereof impact. But to just remind ourselves that I was in a morning staff meeting of Zaghibi International when our receptionist came in and said that a plane had hit head on the World Trade Center. And we stopped the meeting immediately, though not realizing what the impact was or what really had happened. By the time we had ended the meeting and gotten back to our respective offices, of course, the second plane had hit the World Trade Center, and then we knew what was happening. So many things that flowed through my mind, not the least of which was you were a freshman at Le Moyne at the time. It was among your first days at school, and I was worried about you. The first call is to family. And you had experienced, I'll let you tell about it, you had experienced some negativity already, and we just suggested that you come home, that this was a time that we should all be together and bond, which you did, and which I'm glad you did. But why don't you just tell your side of the story, and then I want to get into the impact as well.
Well, you know, for me, it's hard for me to separate events. You know, memories lead to the past, and there's always implications and everything. So, you know, it's a bit emotional, and it was for our family. I have to go back to the winter of 98, in which our first cousins in D.C., it was, I think, one of the last times they had been up to Utica. I think those were the last days of Sithi, my grandmother, your mother. And Joe Zaghibi, the second eldest of the first cousins, took us out to see a movie. And it was the movie The Siege. Do you remember The Siege? Remember the guy from Wings, the Lebanese character from Wings who played in the movie? And this was in 1998. And basically, for those who don't remember the movie, it was a terrorist attack in New York City. And in the movie, they ended up rounding up either the Arab population or the Muslim population or even both. And there's just this dramatic movie that basically was about martial law. And so 3 years later, well, let me back up. We had finished watching the movie. I think it was most of the first cousins. And actually, to this day, I'm convinced that Joe had a reason for taking us to see that movie. I'm convinced, although we've never talked about it, that he was planting a seed in all of us, or trying to, about the necessity of civil rights. And so we were in the mall and walking around bewildered, and with a sense of urgency, I went up to Joe and I said, do you think this could ever happen to us? Right? Because the central character in the movie was Lebanese. And I don't really remember his answer, but I remember the look on his face, and he was in great distress, and that spoke volumes to me. So fast forward to that morning, I had only been a freshman in college for, you know, about 2 weeks on campus. And then, of course, that happened. And I remember the day is clear as day and a lot of the events. But there's one that sticks out. And this guy called in and he said on the phone, he said, we're going to have to round up every Muslim in this nation. And I was like, wow, I saw that movie 3 years ago. Now, luckily, that didn't happen. But if you can imagine the weeks that preceded, you had a bomb threat at the call center. Uncle Jim had death threats to him and his daughters. And so these weeks were terrifying. And we can get back to this, but I'll just say that, you know, many people were changed completely on that day. Many people, many of us were living an insulated life, and I can speak for myself and many others that shattered that insulation. And some went to religion, many went to religion, some enlisted in the military, some went to travel the world. I hit the books, and I was lucky in that I already knew, had already known that I wanted to immerse myself in history. And so it became a quest to understand this world and this complicated world in which we live. And I've since then learned through you, through my studies, and through Uncle Jim, many lessons that I think have implications and application for today.
So you're reminding me of my experience, which was terrifying. There was a bomb scare followed up by another bomb scare. We had to shut down our operations completely because of that. There were moments of kindness. I will never forget that the diversity of folks. Jack Kemp, the great conservative congressman, called me up to ask me if I'm okay. James Carville, the very liberal political consultant, called me up and said, I hope your kids are okay. I heard about your son and an experience that he had, and I'm worried about him. Tell me you're all right. Tim Russer of NBC News called to see if I was okay. And there were others across the spectrum. There were emails that were hateful beyond any level that anyone could possibly understand. And there's no need to dwell on those except to say that they were there. And these are the sorts of people that do the same sort of thing on social media today. But with all of that said, just to broaden the scope a little bit, I'm still touched by, on one hand, the impact that it's had on us, the visual, the sense that we've had to ask ourselves an awful lot of questions, including the fact that we went to war and then went into two wars and then eventually failed at both wars. Iraq is no better off, in fact, worse off than it was before 2003. And Afghanistan is Afghanistan. I don't even know how to describe it any other way, but except that we lost a lot of bodies and a lot of treasure and a lot of our soul in the process. On the other hand, I'm struck, Jared, by how little it's changed us. When those planes flew in and those towers collapsed, my immediate thought was, we're in a whole different era. And we're not. In fact, we're in a continuation still of the post-Vietnam era, which is, if you're going to get involved in a war, then number one, you better win. Number two, you better know how to get out. And number three, that our involvement should have made things better for the host country and not worse. And those were lessons of Vietnam. And I think that the American public, not policymakers necessarily, but the American public have learned that lesson. Number two, get those wars over with quickly. You know, because you've heard this many times, but I want our listeners to know, we had the foresight back when we could get on the phones again in our call center to do a series of daily tracking polls of the American public. No one had ever done that before. In the middle of a war, track to see how culture and attitude, maybe even values, had changed. And among the poignant questions we asked every day was, do you support or oppose a war on terror? Remember, President Bush declared it shortly after 9/11. You know, and 91% said that they supported the war on terror. What if this war on terror were to last 6 months to a year? Do you still support or oppose it? 77% supported it. What if this were to take a year or 2 years? Then it was in the 60s that supported. What if it were to take more than 2 years? Support was down to the 50s. 57% supported it. And here we were, remember now, within days after 9/11, and already there was a nuance. Already there were questions about a war on terror. Already there were the lessons of Vietnam, which is, no matter how noble the cause, no matter how large the need for revenge, if we're going to go to war, make sure it's over and make sure it wins. The other thing that I was struck by was we asked about the impact of 9/11. And each day what we saw were differences among regions, so that the Northeast was highly captivated by the events of 9/11. Much less so were residents on the West Coast. That got me thinking even back then, what if it had been the Golden Gate Bridge that had been attacked? Would we have felt the same huge impact on the West Coast? Yet those of us here in the Northeast starting to slowly realize and have the impact dissipate as we felt, well, that was 3,000 miles away. That really doesn't have much to do with me. In other words, there were cracks that we saw, chinks in the armor in terms of public opinion and public support. A lot of it having to do with geography, but a lot of it too having to do with the fact that we were still, and I think still today, are very much in the post-Vietnam War era. What do you think?
Wow, that was an encyclopedia of data, and there's a lot of wisdom in that. And because you laid out the data, you know, I guess I'll just stick to perspective, but I have to remind you that there was something you said, I think, in the weeks that followed 9/11 that really planted, I mean, probably among the first seeds that, you know, grew like wild vines. You said to me, democracy is not like a baseball hat. It's not one size fits all. And, you know, I mean, maybe to some people that could seem obvious, but there's so much wisdom in that. And, you know, Uncle Jim at the time was, you know, calling out the Patriot Act, representing his people, but not just his people, the Arab Americans and the Arabs in this country. He was actually representing all of humanity by talking about this dangerous piece of legislation. And, you know, like I said, I already had it set. The path, my path was clear. I was going to hit the books and study history. And, you know, one of the things that I think maybe the greatest thing that I've learned comes from what you said. You know, democracy is not a baseball hat. It's not one size fits all. That kind of lends itself to the nature of empires and empire building. And that's very relevant because, you know, especially for nations in this world that take rule of law as paramount, you know, the thing that defines their people and their history, the notion of empire building abroad is dangerous because justice at home is usually the first victim. In other words, you can't have an empire and then not have a police state at home in one form or another. And, if there are lessons to be learned from 9/11, I think it was obviously the picture that you and I both painted with our stories and the immediate reactions and observations after the event was the general sense of fear that exponentially grew and gripped the nation, and a fear towards the other, an enemy. And luckily, we in many ways we did get our act together, but in other ways we didn't. But today, that's as relevant as ever. As you know, very early on in this podcast, when we started it, I mean, really by the fourth or the fifth episode, COVID-19 exploded. And I mean, as early as episode 9, I was drawing the analogy and saying, this is like a medical 9/11. And you can slice and dice that in different ways. But I think the overarching theme is that, or common denominator, is that fear and that growing sense of fear and the fear towards the other. Mm-hmm. And if I keep, you know, drilling over and over and over that fear of the other eventually turns to a loss of empathy towards the other. And once you have that loss of empathy towards the other, you can't articulate the other's standpoint. You can't articulate their fears. And if we're going to learn anything from 9/11 and apply it today, I think we have to be cognizant of foreign policy. Like you said, is not a baseball hat. It doesn't fit. One size doesn't fit all. The question is what about domestic policies? Does the same principle apply? Whatever the domestic policy is, does one size fit all? We had the national security state. Today we have the biosecurity state. There's a growing sense of fear towards each other. What can we do to avoid that spiraling out of control? And I'll leave it at that.
Well, you've heard me on a number of occasions talk about the antidote. And the antidote really is you, is millennials and Gen Z who have a passion for justice, have an impatience over dithering, of seeing global problems and demanding that global problems be resolved, not, you know, kicked like a can down the road. So one of the things that also emerged from that post 9/11 survey was that I had already started work defining, outlining how millennials were different on so many policies, particularly foreign policies and policies impacting race and ethnicity and immigration and so on. But one of the things that emerged as we polled about 9/11 and the war on terror was that while the majority of those over 45 wanted revenge for the dastardly attack, the majority of those under 30 were saying, wait, what would make people do this? I want to understand. Are these the same kinds of people that we listen to the same music, that we share our cultures with online that, you know, want to travel like I travel? How do we go from shared interests and the growing sense that millennials had back then of, hey, these are people just like me, to something this horrible and this hateful? There was more of a tendency to kind of equivocate and to not talk about one size fits all, not want to paint all Muslims, all Arabs, all whoever, you know, with one broad stroke. And so that, for me at least, was encouraging. There was another image that emerged from 9/11 too, and I'm hard pressed to find another time since then that we've seen this image, and that is in front of the Capitol. Dick Gephardt, who at the time was the majority leader of the House of Representatives, a Democrat, of course, Mitch McConnell, who was minority leader of the U.S. Senate at the time, arm in arm, as Democrats and Republicans together in the House and in the Senate, saying God bless America in the name of unity. And I'm trying very, very hard, Jared, to think of another time since then. That's 20 years ago exactly, that Democrats and Republicans showed that kind of unity and that kind of consensus. And it's not coming to me. And any of those of you who are out there listening who can are watching can correct me, please correct me. But I think that's the last time that we've had that kind of conviviality and congeniality. Very sad circumstance, but that, unfortunately, I don't know if that's a lasting impact of 9/11, but 9/11 didn't change it. In fact, after 9/11, the hyper partisanship that we all talk about actually worsened. Nope, I'm not coming up with anything. But please, final word from you.
No, I was just saying I'm thinking and thinking and you're thinking and thinking and it's just not there. I don't think it's there. But I hope that people will continue to share this episode, especially this one, because, you know, 20 years that's an important time frame from September 11, 2001 till today. And I think the lessons that we shared and what we talked about, I remain convinced are as relevant as ever. And so it's something for people to think about.
Now, speaking of millennials and change, we have a programming note. October 8th, during this podcast, we will be interviewing Parag Khanna, famed best-selling world author of several books. His newest, which is coming out on that very day, is called Move. And it's about the movement of young people throughout the world, immigration and refugees, those who choose for a better life, and how the massive drive of 2 billion people, mainly young people, is changing and will continue to change so much that makes up our world. We'll have more about that in the interim weeks, but please make a note of that he'll be on our Friday, October 8th podcast. That's all for me. Final word from you?
Signing off.
Okay. Have a good week, everybody. Let us hear from you again, as you've been very generous with your comments. Bye-bye now.